been along. Dad, come
in. Hi, good afternoon. It's lovely Monday in September, and it's time for Dialogue Conspiracy to think about the more gloomy aspects of life. I don't look at my research as being gloomy, really. I think usually I'm optimistic. I have my low days, I have my high days, and I hope that the work comes to some value, that we can find out where justice is served and what is truth, and where we can find information about conspiracies for the purpose of their stopping to exist, for people not getting together and committing crimes against us that are organized from the White House or the Justice Department on down through the local police departments with the help of the FBI and the intelligence agencies. We hope someday that they'll stop conspiring against us and making war with us, but it's hard let up. They're not giving much up, and you've got to fight every day, and hope that the evidence of the conspiracies that do exist will be made known to people, and that people will get out of their lethargy or apathy and demand to see the hardcore evidence that constitutes a criminal conspiracy. The new Realist is out this Friday. It'll be at the Thunderbird locally and up at Santa Cruz and bookstores, and hopefully people in Salinas and whoever listens to the show will be able to get it in the Bay Area or Monterey Peninsula. The cover of the new issue of The Realist has a picture of Truman Capote in a goldfish bowl. Then there's an article inside called Why Truman Capote Went to Jail. And there's a picture of him in the goldfish bowl. I got a copy of this, an uncut edition Friday. It came to me in the mail. They're not on the stand yet. Paul Krasner sent me a copy Friday. And Saturday morning at 7:30 a.m., I was awakened with a telephone call from New York City. And this woman said, oh, you're on WBAI in New York right now. And I didn't know if she was the announcer doing the radio program. It didn't sound like it. And usually Bob Foss is the one that I've talked to, WBAI, and 7:30 in the morning. And she said, no, there's a tape that they played, a tape that I made, an hour tape about the Watergate. And it was played in New York City a Friday night, and then they played it again. It was a four-part series, 1 hour of Sherman Skolnick from Chicago talking about the airplane crash and Mrs. Hunt, and Don Freed in L.A. talking about the Gemstone Papers and the conspiracy of the Watergate group that had been working since Dallas together, the link of the conspiracies and the Gemstone Papers that involved the actual break-in at the Watergate Hotel, the whole conspiratorial team working for 10 years together. That was his subject. And then I did an hour on the Watergate. We did this show after the hearings took a vacation in the summertime. There was a summary show, and they've been playing at different cities in L.A. and in New York. And the woman who called me was Mrs. Capote, and I thought she had seen the issue of The Realist with Truman's picture in the goldfish bowl. And it was such a coincidence, because I had just received the copy, and it was Mrs. Capote on the phone and Truman Capote's stepmother. And we talked about my favorite story, the Christmas story that he had written in the television movie with Geraldine Page. And I told her about the article. She hadn't seen it, and about the picture of him in the bowl. And she said that Truman is in danger, and she thought he would be killed, that he knew too much. He was part of the government, that the conspirators had encircled him in their entourage and use him as a kind of a plaything. She was going to send me information about him and the situation. She thought that they had tried to kill him in the car crash he had a while ago. And when I mentioned this to Paul Krasner, he reminded me that when John and Yoko Lennon were in California last summer, Truman Capote tried to get John separated from Yoko and set up an orgy down in Los Angeles with the Los Angeles Police Department. If you can imagine anything less stimulating or exciting, whatever turns you on. But the Lennons are in trouble in this country because John threatened to be deported. And I had that in my article, the new one that's out, just mentioned the fact of the planted grass in his binocular case in England before he came here, and then as an excuse they could deport him here if he became politically active, and they keep that hanging over his head. So Truman Capote was arranging a setup, a frame-up of John Lennon last summer, which is an interesting little side bit about the article in The Realist and talking with Mrs. Capote in New York City. In the interim of the break of the Watergate thing, a lot of people have asked me about the meaning of the case, how far it was going to go, how does it relate to the past conspiracies, and there's been so much discussion of it and requests for people to come to my home and use my library, and I haven't really let people in because I've been so busy writing, that I decided that I would start a course on the Watergate. When I wrote the article for The Realist, I mentioned that there was no academic course in studying conspiracies. The first section of the new article is called Knowledge Omitted from the Campus. And I bring out the point that the news media doesn't handle conspiracies accurately. They have indifference or platitudes or cover stories that they throw out, and the colleges and academic institutions don't teach us about espionage operations, and there's nothing to protect society from sabotage or treason. We can't understand that word except in vague terms. But after I wrote that article and went to the printers, I read this fall that three universities so far are giving courses in conjunction with either political science or one with the law department on the meanings of the Watergate, because so many lawyers were involved. And I decided it was time in my own local community, or for people that can get down from Santa Cruz that are interested, that I would start a course in my home starting a week from next Wednesday of people interested in understanding conspiracies. And I won't take more than eight for a series, and I thought I'd do it every Wednesday night for 5 weeks and begin in our own local community to have people study those more seriously interested in understanding the news media and the whole process of a planning a conspiracy, how to recognize a conspiracy, and maybe have a group continuously when one series ends, and if it's successful, have another group. And I'm going to charge a certain price for each person to attend. And if you're interested, write to KLRB or call me at my home after the show is over. Give me time to get home, an hour or two, or write a letter to KLRB if you're in the Santa Cruz area, or want to send a postcard, and let me know if you're interested in attending such a course. What I plan to do would be to take the first session would be on the sources of information for research and studying, and we'll go into the transcripts of trials, because this always comes up and people want to know, where do you get your information from, what is accurate, who do you believe, and what is truth. So the first session, I thought I have the Warren Commission hearings, which is 26 volumes of testimony that was set under oath, and it also includes FBI reports and State Department documents, police reports, autopsy papers, and these are very important. I have copies of autopsies, say, of Marilyn Monroe or Robert Kennedy, and some of these famous murders, to show that they're an absolute discrepancy with what the media said was the cause of death, the John Kennedy autopsy, the circumstances of that. So the important thing is to say in the first session, talk about sources of information. There is first what you call the actual homicide or documents before the crime of certain people's behavior, like Lee Harvey Oswald's entrance to college, his college requirements, his IQ, his State Department degree in electronics, a copy of his security clearance, top secret security clearance, his radar training, his qualifications in radar and electrical work, his station at Sugi Air Base where he worked with the U-2. These are documentary pieces of evidence that don't match the cover story of, say, what Lee Harvey Oswald was after the crime was committed. So the sources of information that you get to study any conspiracy consist of trial records, transcripts or commission hearings, or copies of data like autopsy things. Then you have your reference books, and there's two kinds of books. There's books that have an index that you can look up, like Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment, which has a volume number, page number, that you could look it up in the commission hearings, or Sylvia Mayer's book, Accessory After the Fact. You have a book by Robert Houghton, Chief of Detectives, after the Robert Kennedy murder in Los Angeles, and there was a lawsuit placed against that book, which has no index at all. So Computer and Automation did an index of that book as a public service, so you can look up what witnesses weren't called and who was called, and how the conspiracy is concealed in a book. In other words, there's some books that are actually academic as much as they're serious books on a subject. They have an index. You can look up the references and check them out. There's books without references or index, and you can read those. I have 109 books on the John Kennedy assassination alone. And you can judge for yourself after handling or looking a few of them, which you think are the serious ones, which are the cover-ups, and go through these books. Then there's newspaper articles, which I've kept in chronological order of the major assassinations, the John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. Some of my notebooks were stolen when I moved in January. Somebody came in my house the night that I moved and took 5 volumes out of the John Kennedy assassination series that are irreplaceable. And thank you. Some people helped me move, and the house was empty. I was between 2 homes that night, and 5 of those were gone. But I have chronological clippings of the Wallace shooting, and now the J. Edgar Hoover murder, and the Chappaquiddick affair, and the Manse and the Sharon Tate, because that's an important cultural, political series of murders. And I keep those things in chronological order. And so that first meeting would be on sources of information for research. And then the second meeting, we'd go into the evidence and witnesses on how to separate what the witnesses and the physical evidence of a trial to recognize conspiracies, because a lot of evidence is collected at the time of murders. There are bullets, namely, and there's weapons, and there's fingerprints, and again, the autopsy records. But the evidence is usually the location of the bullet in a particular person. Say in Robert Kennedy, the autopsy says he was shot from 1 inch from the back of the head, and there's a certain amount of bullets that were shot in the Ambassador Hotel. There's 10 bullets in the Los Angeles Police Department, and Sirkahan's gun only shot 8. And the night that of the shooting of Robert Kennedy, the police department threw away the gun that Sirhan had in his hand, and it was replaced at the trial with another gun. They had 2 serial numbers. So we're talking about evidence. Bullets, how many bullets are around, say, in the Wallace shooting at the shopping center in Maryland? How many guns? Arthur Braemer had 2 weapons in his car. The FBI only found 1. The local police found 2. So we go into how many guns are, how to recognize when these murders take place, or past ones. How many bullets there were, how many guns, where was the bullet location in the victim, like Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, or George Wallace, you see. And then you have certain evidence that's available. Then you have certain evidence that's destroyed. And when it comes time for their particular trials, if they have a trial, in the John Kennedy, we've gone over evidence that was destroyed before. There's evidence that's altered later. There's all evidence that's missing. There's change of testimony and evidence. A perfect example in the Watergate was this last week. We heard before the hearings closed, we heard Robert Haldeman give testimony how he was home on a Sunday and his advisor gave him some tapes that belonged to the White House, and he took them home and listened to them. And he said this under oath before the committee. Now it turns out that Lawrence Higbee didn't give him these tapes, and his lawyer sent a letter to the committee this last week. In August the 10th, he sent a letter to Sam Ervin from Frank Strickler, one of Haldeman's attorneys. And he said that Haldeman, in quotes, believes now that on July the 10th, he received the September 15th tapes, plus phone call tapes from White House Steve Bull while he was at the home of Mr. Higbee. But he had received them from another person. Now, it's different than what he said under oath, how he received these tapes. Haldeman said, Strickler said that Haldeman testified that he took the tapes, but he didn't listen to them. But on July the 12th, he put the tapes in a manila envelope in a case with a machine and returned the package to Steve Bull, who he thinks picked them up at the executive office building. Now he's uncertain in the letter, which is sent to the Senate committee in August, about where Mr. Bull got them or who picked them up. And his attorney says that he's a trifle uncertain as to where they were delivered. In other words, what he said under oath was one thing. Now, who gave them to him, the machine they were played on, how they were returned is totally changed since the summer vacation. So this is evidence which is, I put it under altered and also under delayed. It's a question, are the tapes altered? And then this is delayed evidence because it comes in 2 or 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later that a different chain of command handled those White House tapes than what he said under oath. So that there's a lot of evidence, also there's evidence on tip-offs, where somebody would call from Alabama and call the FBI and say, go to Klein's gun store in Illinois. Oswald ordered a gun from Klein's. Well, who placed the tip-off? Who was the minister down in the South that placed the tip-off? Why wasn't he a witness before the Warren Commission? They know who he was. Who writes Death to the Pigs on the door? Who leaves the cover stories, the diaries around? These are pieces of evidence. And then there's witness testimony. So in the second session, we talk about witness testimony. Who is called before these hearings? Now, this comes up in the Kent State that I want to go into in a little while. There was no grand jury on the Kent State, and the local authorities had witnesses who saw a man with a gun. They saw him fire the gun. He wasn't called to testify. In the Sirhan case, there were witnesses on the radio the night that Robert Kennedy was shot saying they saw a man whose name turned out to be Thane Caesar hold a gun, and he shot it. It went off that night in the Ambassador Hotel. Why aren't these witnesses called before the local police? Why aren't they called before the FBI, whether it's Kent State or in the Ambassador Hotel? And the important thing about studying conspiracies is that the similarities run through all of the conspiracies. And I'm going to show you why, too, in an illustration, if we have time today, of why the witness similarity is the same and doesn't fit the picture evidence. And then the third part of a conspiracy is who investigates it. Now, in some cases, like in the John Kennedy, it was a Warren Commission. And in the case of the Watergate, it's the Senate Select Committee. And some of these cases go to a judge, like James Ray or Sirhan or Arthur Brammer. But they have many trials. And then who are the defense lawyers? You see, the defense lawyer does as much to get the man in jail for life or get killed as the prosecution lawyer. So how does the defense lawyer get assigned to it? Percy Forman came in to defend James Earl Ray. It was a last-minute switch, so the trial lasted 30 minutes, and James Ray went to jail for life. There must be a defense lawyer for Arthur Brammer. I forget who it is, but he hasn't even been tried on federal crime, which he's supposed to be tried, but they've let him off so far. The defense lawyer, Melvin Belli for Jack Ruby, got him in jail for life, and then he was killed in jail. The defense lawyers do not do a very good job of saving their clients. And where do they come from? How do they get on the case? The American Opinion came out with an article just this month on the killing of the Rosenbergs and feeling that it wasn't fair, that there was forged evidence, it was evidence against them, that they shouldn't have died. This is the American Opinion, the John Birch Society, saying that Julius and Ethel Rosenberg should not have died for what they were charged with doing. And the article blames the defense lawyer, that he could have cross-examined the major witness, Mr. Gold, over and again. Here is the position of the Birch Society, criticizing the defense lawyer for the Rosenbergs being responsible for their getting the death penalty. So there is a question of who prosecutes and who defends, because I have a manuscript which says that the lawyers for these conspiracy cases come out of Muscle Shoals, Alabama, from the Defense Intelligence Security Command. And then the grand jury that convenes. Which grand juries let them off, and which press for prosecutions? Why do some grand juries not take any testimony and say we don't have any evidence of conspiracies, and others come down and force a conspiracy where none existed, like in all these famous anti-war radical trials that have been going on that have been dismissed? They say we have a case, the grand jury is forced to make a case out of nothing. It costs the state and up to $1 million for some of these big trials. It costs the defendants hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they didn't have a case in the first place. And then the role of the local police department. Which ones are filled with agents from the CIA, assassination squads? What can be done about it? How do you recognize it? And the county coroner, who often is part of the Central Intelligence Agency to cover suicides, cover murders and say they're suicides, cover outright slaughter as justifiable homicide. So the first series that I would have would be sources of information. The second would be evidence of witness. And the third would be the investigative body. Then the fourth evening would be on motives and who gains and who loses if it is a conspiracy based upon the evidence and the manipulative news coverage as against books that are published with more factual documentation, manipulation of witnesses, who gained or who lost. Now, this kind of a program where we study will take you into future books that you read and future articles And then you may want to go back and read some of the Cold War, World War One, the end of World War One, the rearmament of Germany, and the World War Two, the beginning of the Cold War, the National Security Council, how high up do these conspiracies go? And the question is, who closes the cases before they ever get started, and who can you trust? And that would be the fourth subject, and it would go into my library, which has about 300 books on these various subjects now, but there's so many books out, I would use the tuition money to buy new books that are pouring out because I can't afford them, and there's a lot of material that I need, a lot of books that I should keep my library up and complete. And then the fifth series, in the first meeting in the series, would be a chain of command from the White House and the Council of Foreign Relations and the Domestic Security Council, and the interrelationship of the Justice Department, the FBI, the CIA, the federal agents. The investigative body would pertain to specific conspiracy cases on the way they covered up, and the other would be the chain of command, like the interagency police that Richard Nixon signed in 1970. That was active ever since the National Security Council came into existence. They really didn't need a signature on this document. I think they all signed it or agreed to it so that each would be responsible in case anybody ever did get caught. It involved all the branches of the armed forces and the intelligence agencies, the White House, the FBI, the CIA, and the President of the United States. And they're all involved in these conspiratorial cases. So we would start with the Watergate and show how they operated previously, going all the way back since the time of World War II. And then if you take this course and have five evenings in trying to understand this, I hope from there, and simultaneously while we're doing it, that people would be getting writing letters and getting to public officials and becoming educated and use this information. And then whoever takes the course would have access to the books that I have in my library that they could check out on their own if they return them or promise to replace them, and too many aren't out at one time, I would loan them out. I think it's very important to get with this and study the history of the 60s or 70s. In the article that I did, this new one in The Realist, there's a section called Martial Law Without the Raids, and there's a list of institutions. It isn't a complete thing. Again, this article's a short article, considering how much information I have. And there's a list of institutions that are nothing but repressive and set the framework for a total police state. And these include the Office of Management Budget, the Office of Emergency Service, DALE, that's the new drug in law enforcement, the UCLA Institute to study the cause of violence behavior, NSCIDS, which is part of the National Security Council, and Atascadero and Vacaville prisons, where they're doing chemical and physical experimentations and torture on various prisoners in California. And the U.S. Medical Facility, the federal prisons now at Springfield, Missouri, and New York State, the Adirondack Treatment Center, and in North Carolina, the Butner Behavior Research Center, where they're going to start moving prisoners around the different states to lose their roots, to lose the families, and to experiment them on behavior modification. And this, of course, is all for political prisoners. And the new proposed cabinet in California that would take care of the military, the prisons, law enforcement, and the Office of Emergency Service in one unit. Well, those are just a few examples of the tighter police state that we're going into. In spite of the Watergate, Mr. Nixon has held his own, and the apathy seems so great, and people can't realize that each one of these plus maybe 50 more dangerous groups are still cohesive, getting the money, and doing what they want to manipulate the population in the next 4 years until they can get Ronald Reagan in there and really be sure that they have a total manipulative situation. There's a book out, a new book by Samuel Lubell. It's called The Future While It Happened, and it's about Richard Nixon, and it's very much like the thing that I'm trying to bring out in the Realist article about the dangerous control that Mr. Nixon has. And the point of the book is that the Watergate, he doesn't go in too much about the Watergate. What he says is that when Nixon is resigned or removed from office, when he leaves his office, and it doesn't matter whether he's assassinated, resigns, or is impeached, or serves 4 years, by the time he leaves, he has our country in a bind for the next several hundred years of total repression. That, and Mr. Lubell says in his own words, by putting Americans to war against each other over a spectrum of issues, race, welfare, jobs, peace, war, against youth and age, he has used his power these years that he's been the president to shape the future right now. That if you really read your paper, and it goes into the fact how he wooed the labor leaders, he timed up, you know, worked with the Teamsters and the Mafia, let Hoff out of jail in exchange for votes, and put Charles Colson in with the Teamsters, and went into combining the White House energies to make sure he got this last election, because what after came after that didn't matter. He dangled textile import quotas before the people in the South. He turned off the draft so that the anti-war youth would cool down and not be so angry about the draft movement. But the main thing is the spirit that I'm writing in the book, Murderville Now, Murderville USA, is the war against each other that he started, and the Supreme Court has turned people, their minds, to believing that maybe they're a just court or a fair court. Well, he has manipulated through his Justice Department and to his funding of his crime bill, the new LEAA funds that never should have been renewed. He is funding and manipulating the minds of the people of the world that he and his associates want. Now, a perfect example of that is a study that was done in against or about pornography that Congress did. In Congress had a study to cost $1.7 million, and Richard Nixon asked them to see the effect of pornography upon society, what it does to criminals, what it does in causing rape, and he asked his Congress to come up with a solution or a suggestion of what pornography was doing in this country. Now, Richard Nixon wanted the CIA to help him with a Stop the Watergate investigation. He said, is there anything going on there that we shouldn't know about Cuba or your CIA conduits down in Mexico and South America? And the CIA said no. So then he put pressure upon them still to tell Patrick Gray to stop the investigation. He wanted his own way. He asked the CIA about the anti-war riots, the black people rioting, the unrest in this country. He said, find out if it's coming from Algiers, if it's coming from foreign countries, who's funding all these protesters. And the CIA came back with the conclusion that the restlessness in the ghettos, the restlessness of youth against the war, was the natural result of domestic crisis in our country. So Richard Nixon didn't like that, so he formed his special little group with the armed forces and members of the FBI and members of the CIA that would then proceed to open into buildings and get what they want out and open mailboxes and listen to conversations, all clearly illegal because he didn't like the result that the CIA gave him. Well, he asked Congress to study this pornography, and they spent $1.7 million. They worked 27 months, a period of social scientists that worked serious on this subject, and they had 3,250 pages of information, and what they came out with was the result of all these college professors. These weren't hippies or people turned on to grass or radicals. These were very conservative professors, sociologists in the establishment. And what they recommended when they finished their study on pornography was that you should repeal the laws that barred people from access to sexual books and films. Take them away. They don't hurt anybody. Take the laws away. Their conclusion was that this pornography didn't hurt anybody, and maybe it added a little pleasure. Now, this work turned out to be a failure only because the president didn't like it. Like his study on violence or his study on pornography, he wouldn't recognize this report that they turned out. He turned his back on it. And the professors that put it together were very upset about it. They said that these citizens came together and they put this serious study, and the president, like the crime bill, put it aside and wouldn't have anything to do with the conclusions. So what did the president do? He goes to the justice of the Supreme Court and the men that he has put on the Supreme Court, like Mr. Rehnquist and Mr. Powell, and he comes to a pornography law, which, like in Greece, they came down on pornography, and when Greece was overthrown and the military junta was put in by our CIA, they cracked down on pornography and dress code. Richard Nixon went to the justices of the Supreme Court, and he came out with a law, which was very interesting. He said, we're going to leave it to the individual states to decide what they should do on pornography. We're not going to make a one issue. We're not going to dictate what you should see, what movies you should see, what books you should read, but we'll let the individual states decide what to do. But in the meantime, a bill is going through Congress. If you don't stop it and write to the proper authorities, that bill 1400 to the Senate Judiciary, that would make anybody who violates an obscenity law in their own city by having certain books depicting sexual intercourse or movies a criminal charge. Now, there would be no other minor charge, and you'd go to a state or federal penitentiary. It would be a criminal charge where you could get a lot of years in jail and heavy fines. The law is set now to make breaking the pornography laws a criminal charge, and the Supreme Court has thrown it back to the states. So then the criminal fund bill that went through last month, the LEAA, then funded $200,000 to a Lutheran church out in California. Now, this is the way Richard Nixon plays fair, you know, the great football player, the great team player. He set up a group of men on his discussion of pornography, and everyone went along with it except one man. He was the loser. This man lives out in California. His name is Reverend Morton A. Hill, and he's a Jesuit priest, and he was the minority opinion, one out of a whole team, on this panel of pornography. So Mr. Morton Hill goes out to California, where LEAA, the federal fund, gave him $200,000, just gave him $200,000 of federal money. Now, what's he going to use with his federal money? This is just in California. His organization has set up offices in Houston, Colorado, Miami, Boston, Tennessee, Providence, Rhode Island, Salt Lake City, and Louisiana, in Baton Rouge and Shreveport. Now, we don't know, and it'd be worth investigating, whether LEAA sent $200,000 to these eight locations. But you have your military-industrial complex, again, the people that have been putting military dictatorships in these other countries from Tennessee, the Mormon group in Salt Lake City and Utah, the Howard Hughes clique, California, Utah, Texas, Tennessee, and Miami coming in, and Rhode Island. Now, California got $200,000 alone. I don't know if these other states did or not. Now, this is what they're going to do. They have a California base down in Thousand Oaks, called the National Legal Data Center of Obscenity. And I'm going into this slowly because you can pertain this to all the past conspiracy trials, the political prisoners, and the prison radical things, the way they came down, and now they're hitting pornography, the war on pornography. The $200,000 from the federal government. The federal government that funded $1.2 million to come to the conclusion the pornography law should be revoked spends another $200,000 to set up a legal data center of obscenity in California. Now, an ex-FBI man by the name of Homer Young runs this, and it's called the National Data Center, and it goes into the data bank back east. It's a computerized data bank on pornography working inside this Lutheran church by retired FBI agents. And I don't have to tell you in the Watergate how many retired FBI agents were, like Mr. Baldwin, taking those tapes across from the Howard Johnson Hotel and James McCord. There's about 15 FBI agents, X in quotes. Well, Mr. Kelly, the new head of the FBI, made a big speech the other day promising. He didn't say he would find justice or he'd be fair or he'd eke out equal justice. He made a speech that made the headline saying, I'm going to make this FBI more efficient. And he's the big daddy of data banks, computers, and so forth. So if Mr. Hill, Reverend Hill, inside the Lutheran church has a data bank about who shows a dirty movie or who has a dirty book, they'll let Kelly know, and Kelly will be very efficient, and he'll come down and arrest them. That's how the efficiency is going to work. Now, they have quarterly reports that they send into the LEAA that the Justice Department is going to be using. This will be a big tattletale thing, and a data bank around the state about who's doing what and showing what and seeing what, and it'll go right to the Justice Department in Washington. Our taxpayers' money is funding this particular group who are going to tattle to the Justice Department with data banks, and that isn't all. Then they're going to have write up ordinances for obscenity cases getting ready for arrest. And they will provide model, in quotes, pleadings and court orders on what to do on these famous cases. And they will give them trial tactics. They're going to write up trial tactics on how to have trials. So if there's been 15 trials against obscenity cases in the country, they'll send those off to the, and give other cases where the arrest takes place right to the local police, the jury, the judge, and they'll have models. And private money is donated too. And that will go off. They will write ordinances for every local city. They're going to cooperate with that, and they're going to give them models. And they have a data bank, and they're going to send them other trial tactics, they're called. They're going to develop tactics for prosecution to get these people in the jail. Now, this is important. They're going to provide expert witnesses. Now, in the Vincenzo Ramos trial down in Riverside that just took place, where two young people were given a life sentence for killing a guard. They weren't in the area, and six people have been arrested. A Warren Beatty, who's a known criminal and in on heavy charges, just got immunity, and he's out in exchange for rounding up radicals. In the Berrigan case, you had Mr. Boyd down, you had Mr. Lemmer down in the Gainesville case with the Vietnam veterans, and I could list off about 12 famous government conspiracy cases in the San Quentin Six. It was Stephen Bingham. They're going to provide witnesses. And in your famous trials, you have certain guards, you have certain police. They're going to have witnesses to pornography cases. And then they're going to have a brief bank. They already have 117 legal briefs against obscenity. And they have these ready, and whenever there's an arrest, it'll give a prosecutor previous cases that he can fall back on a brief bank. And they'll provide the prosecutor with information on other cases. This particular group is going to help every prosecutor wherever somebody's arrested. And you can imagine a man in Illinois is arrested for showing deep throat, and all he has to do, the prosecutor is supply before they make the arrest. They probably have data banks. They can go to the FBI, to this local group, LDAA, and get all the information on a railroad, this guy. Because in 23 cities, deep throat wasn't shown. Therefore, why do we need in Illinois? And they're going to have instant help for the prosecutors to take this thing along. Remember, the Supreme Court said, we're going to leave it up to the individual jurisdiction. But Mr. Richard Nixon, through his Justice Department, funds the minority opinion of a commission he hired to repress every city in America and make criminals of anybody who goes against the code that he wanted in the first place when he spent $1.5 million on his pornography bill. Now, they're going to provide the Justice Department with information about defense attorneys. They're going to get shady deals. This is in quotes, shady deals on defense attorneys. If you want a copy of the article that I got this from, it's from the Washington Post, August 29th, called The U.S. Hires a college to come down on smut. They're going to tattle on the defense attorneys. If you're arrested in Monterey and you need an attorney to represent you on showing movies, a X-rated movie where adults go of their own free will and nothing has happened to indicate that they can't be able to go that movie, that they're harmful society, or the guys at Fort Ord, they want to go there. If an attorney in town takes you and defends you, this tattletale department is going to send out a thing on, in quote, shady deals. Now, the word in the article that they were going to do shady deals of defense. Now, that involves the Dirty Tricks Department back in the White House. You know how the data bank, they had things, we will get our enemy in litigations, prosecutions, Internal Revenue Service. And so they can use the Justice Department data banks. Remember, John Colville worked for the White House. And he worked for the Treasury Department, went and out of the Justice Department, and gave Lasowitz information. Lasowitz in New York City got $100,000 in 1969 and $22,000 every year after that, plus expenses to run whorehouses, to frame people. You could get defense attorneys for and then corner them while in the process of defending a particular person. I heard of an attorney this week who is going to be with the San Quentin Six, who seems really dedicated and seemed right on, understand what he was doing. I talked to another attorney in town just yesterday, and he said, oh, it's terrible to depend upon that man because sometimes he drinks and sometimes he takes grass, and then, you know, it would blow the whole case. If they know that in advance and they let this man be on the case, then they can come down and bust him later and discredit the person he's defending. So this is one of the things to come down and do, find out shady deals on the defense attorneys. And then they will have anti-obscenity conferences where local prosecutors will be instructed on trial preparation. They've anticipated instructing trial prosecutors, and they'll have training films for local prosecutors also on these cases. And then they'll take it to the libraries and clean out the libraries. And you remember at Salinas High School last year, the controversy of certain books. There was a Chicano that wrote a book that had four-letter words in it. It was a very good book about his feelings in his childhood. And there was a big fight about the English teacher having these books, getting the teacher off the faculty, and getting the books out of the library, or books like Catcher in the Rye. They'll take their book list to the libraries like Nazi Germany and purge all the books that have any mention of intercourse or bodies. Then it'll come down on the magazines you read. That'll be next. And then they're going to mail briefs to the judges. So the prong attack you see here, this is the important thing about what this group is doing. The important thing, and I can't mention it too many times over again, is that the president had a minority opinion, one man who didn't like a report of serious students and sociology professors. And here comes a man, a reverend who probably is not married, this Reverend Morton Hill, a Jesuit priest, who's going to dictate what we should have. There's a marvelous book called Eros Denied. I haven't seen it in print for a few years. And it's about St. Augustine, who was sexually repressed. It's about the freedom of sexuality in the Roman culture and preceding that time in the pre-Christian years, and the freedom of bodies and sex, the enjoyment of sex. And along came St. Augustine. It goes into the terrible hang-ups he had. He couldn't get an erection. He couldn't do his thing. He hated women. And he made all the anti-sexual laws about priests not marrying and nuns marrying Jesus and not having sexual relationships. And he built into the Catholic Church, with his charisma and his own hang-ups, the laws that came down for, you know, centuries, hundreds of years, that were built in because St. Augustine could convince people who also had other problems similar to his to make these the laws and make people obey these standards. And this is what we're getting here, is the same kind of a Jesuit priest who's funded by the federal government with our taxes to tell us what movies to see and what we should do. But it affects everything. It affects the judges who are handed something on opinion of what to think. It affects the prosecutors, the legal system, the public defenders, the man who defends you, your private attorney, the libraries that come into it. In other words, it provides witnesses to prosecute people. And then we have the prisons and the prison system, and they lock them up as criminals, the law to set them as criminals. Now, if you can see this in the framework of what happened to many of the political prisoners, the students that have been railroaded through, and this is the thing that I will apply to the studies that I go through with you on these conspiracy cases. They're set judges prepared in advance, particular judges that handled all of these conspiracy cases. The witnesses that were called, that were provided against the people, were select witnesses, not the witnesses that had testimony of conspiracies, the witnesses that intended to get prosecutions and railroads, whether it was Juan Corona's case, or whether it was Sirhan's case, or Charles Manson, or Frazier up in Santa Cruz. These were railroaded cases, and they were package deals put out by the Justice Department in advance. And what happened, then the Sirhan case goes to the Supreme Court. They say we won't open it. The Kent State goes to the Supreme Court. They say we won't open it. I don't have time now. I was going to do a thing on Kent State. There's a book out by Peter Davis, published at 350 in paperback, called The Truth of Kent State. And every parallel to all the conspiracies comes through here. And I think next week, if I have time, I'd like to do a whole hour and show the relationship of private citizens focusing on a Justice Department that wouldn't open it, the FBI that was involved on it, the man who shot the first gun, who works for the Washington police by being promoted, who was an FBI agent who passed himself off as a photographer that day but really shot. This book has 70 photographs of the students at Kent State, hundreds of yards away from the gunman. There's a photograph of the seven gunmen in a huddle before they took their separate places and shot 13 students, four of whom died. There's a tape cassette of the signal gun going off before the other 30 guards synchronized and shot. There is evidence of people walking away. None of the students were armed. The testimony that they were dangerous was wrong. The shooting took place 2 days before the election of the governor in Ohio, promising law and order. A lot of things happen at these conspiracies. Prior to elections, they kill their selected patsies. The courts are controlled. The media is controlled. And there's a parallel running from John Kennedy right through Kent State, Orangeburg Massacre, and all of these political assassinations. Well, again, our time is up. 45 minutes hardly covers what I bring in to Carrie. But we'll meet again next week and write some letters to the Senate committee telling them you want the hearings televised and you want to see the dirty tricks in their full glory. Okay, I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy featuring research specialist Mae Brussel.